Hi, I'm Frank Ferris, one of the principals of the Palliative Care Interdisciplinary Curriculum. I want to personally thank you for joining us for this module in our series on end-of-life care and hospice care.
So today we're going to talk about LVADs a little bit. The topic is LVAD discontinuation, but I recognize that a lot of people probably haven't even dealt with VADs in general. So we're going to take a little bit of a step back and talk about their indications, talk about exactly what some of the devices are, and then kind of understand their physiology, which is going to help us a little bit more with the discontinuation process. Okay. So who in the room has actually physically seen a VAD before? So three. And have you ever taken care of a patient with a VAD on a medical service or just kind of physically seen it? So one person's actually taking care of a patient with a VAD. Okay. So I'm going to try to get this to be interactive. I'll try to repeat what you guys say for the audience. So what is a VAD and why do we have them? Does anybody remember from the beginning of the year exactly what is a VAD?
Stands for left ventricular assist device.
Correct. So a ventricular assist device. So I think that this is going to be critical for everybody to remember while we're doing this, because I think the more you remember that it's an assist device and it doesn't completely take over the work of the heart, the less anxiety everybody's going to have about this process. Because it's there to assist the heart, it's not completely replacing the heart. Some of the other technologies that we have out there in the world right now actually fully replace the heart. So it's critical to remember that it's just an assist device. So as we think about heart failure, if you remember back to our prior lecture, there's a couple of different classifications of heart failure. There's New York Heart Association class 1 through 4 heart failure, where 4 is really dyspnea at rest and significant issues. And there's that new classification. Does everybody remember the Intermax classification system, where they've really broken down New York Heart Association class 3 and 4 heart failure through a 1 through 7 process? This is going to be really critical as we're talking about evaluation for LVADs. All of this kind of encompasses advanced heart therapies. Okay. As you hear this term advanced heart therapies, it really includes a few categories. So these are the patients that are receiving their traditional heart failure therapy, and they're likely not able to tolerate all of their blood pressure medicines. They may not be able to tolerate their ACE inhibitor. That they're too hypotensive to really get goal-directed therapy. And that they're having frequent hospitalizations and they're having frequent readmissions. And in those cases, we start to think about something like a transplant, or we start to think about ways that we can help them feel better for longer. And that's where we start to reach the advanced heart therapy category, where we start to think about home inotrope therapy or some sort of pump to physically help the heart. This is a graph that when you're around with me, you're going to see me draw probably 10 times a day. So if this over here is your quality of life or your functional status, and this is time, okay? When you first get diagnosed with heart failure of some sort, you usually feel pretty crummy. You're down here. And with current heart failure therapies, you significantly improve. You reach some new stable quality of life, often for a really prolonged period of time where people feel well. And then you have some sort of event where you have your first heart failure exacerbation and your functional status declines, your quality of life gets really poor. This is often your first admission for heart failure. And if you look back, you remember that there's almost a 20% chance of mortality with any sort of hospitalization within the next month. So you're at a really high risk for for death anytime that you have one of these big heart failure exacerbations. But typically, we can get people stronger, and we get them to feeling better, but we don't quite get them back to where they were. And the slide kind of starts. They get sick, we get them better, but not quite all the way back to where they were, and it happens again, and then it starts happening more frequently. And the unpredictability of heart failure is that you never know which one of these is going to be profound enough that it actually takes your life, and you never know quite how far they're going to rebound. And so along this way, I tell people, this is probably a line that you haven't seen on your other graphs before, and this is where I view the role of hospice. Right? If we're getting you back to the hospital, and you're getting well enough that you feel good in between coming back and forth to the hospital, then the hospital is really serving its purpose. But if we get to this stage down here where you come to the hospital and you still feel bad enough that you're below this acceptable quality of life to you, that we send you home to feel bad so that you're going to come back to the hospital and feel worse to get you feeling worse than you did when you felt bad, then the hospital really isn't serving its purpose. And our focus should be getting you where you want to be and trying to improve your quality of life really above that line. As we think about advanced heart therapies, these things include transplant, VADs, and inotropes. Okay? With inotropes, our goal is to hopefully get you above that line so that you can stay above that line for a little bit longer. But usually when somebody's on inotropes and you already are making the heart beat as hard as you can and you get fluid on board, there aren't a lot of tools left in our toolkit other than really invasive advanced heart therapies like VADs and transplants when they come back to the hospital. And so this is a time where you start to think, is this, you know, inotropes aren't going to significantly prolong your life, but the goal is to improve the quality of life for the time that you have. So starting to, you know, when people are starting to cruise towards inotrope therapy, this is when we start to think about, are they going to be a candidate for a VAD or a transplant? Or is this a time where we should think about getting them to a location that, where they want to be, such as home hospice, or with some sort of resources and support outside of the hospital so we can help them the most? And as we start to think about the other advanced heart therapies like transplants and VADs, the goal is to turn back the clock. All right? You're not taking care of the heart failure. You are in some ways, but you're turning back to the clock, back to the beginning, and we're giving them a new baseline with heart failure. And with VADs, we're hoping that this is a few years of new stability. And with transplant, we hope that this line's even longer. But with both, you're still going to have a decline of some sort in the future. With transplant, is it chronic transplant vasculopathy? Is it chronic rejection? Is it recurrent infections from years and years of immunosuppression? Is it cancer that they've developed, skin cancer, bladder cancer, ovarian cancer from their years of immunosuppression? And with a VAD, we're going to talk about kind of some of the complications that lead to this decline. I think that framing this for patients is critically important because as we start to talk about VAD discontinuation, it's the most important step in discontinuing a VAD is talking to the family about discontinuing the VAD before you even put it in. Families have to be mentally prepared for this and understand the concept of what the VAD is for in order for us to really help them. So, this is a read my mind question, so I know you guys love this. What are a couple of the indications for VADs? Like, as we start to think about those patients that are on inotrope therapy, why would we put in a VAD?
low ejection fraction.
Okay. So there's the actually the heart indications, right? Their heart's done, right? That their ejection fraction is so low, and that their risk of death is so high that we have to intervene with some sort of mechanical pump. So in thinking about this transplant VAD dance, have you guys ever heard this concept of destination therapy or bridge to transplant? So those are the two indications I really want everybody to think about. So DT or destination or BTT, which is bridge to transplant. So the first step in somebody that's getting really sick from heart failure is to really determine, are they transplant eligible? So one of the biggest, age, it depends on your transplant center, but as a general rule, it's around 65 in the United States, probably a little bit older at really large active transplant centers. The other, in the Midwest especially, is BMI. So there's kind of a lot of debate about exactly where that BMI should fall, but like looking at patients over a BMI of 35 is really not possible at most transplant centers. They're sometimes pushing the envelope a little bit in the South because they just don't, there are so many patients with heart failure with BMIs over 35, and they're trying to look at the mortality to see if it's similar. But really around a BMI of 35. And social support. We have to know that if we give this precious organ to somebody, that they have the best chance of it giving them the same number of years as somebody else. And so we've got it's an interdisciplinary team that comes together to determine if somebody can really get a heart. Now, there are only 2,000 hearts donated every year in the United States. So we've got to take these thousands and thousands of people that are dying of heart failure every year in America and pick the 2,000 that are going to use the organ appropriately, get the best value from it, and do the best with it. So with that being said, our waits are extremely long. They vary in the United States based on your OPO. Has everybody heard of an OPO? So that's your organ procurement organization. So the United States is divided up by region, and you compete for organs with other hospitals that do transplants within your organ procurement organization. A lot of that has to do with the amount of time that it takes to get a heart out of somebody and into somebody else. In the Midwest, it's like this area of Ohio. When I was in Los Angeles, it's LA County. So bigger or smaller, depending on your population and how long it takes to get organs to where they need to be. So for destination therapy patients, these are patients that are not transplant eligible. Either they have some sort of psychosocial thing that's precluding them, they're a smoker, they're too overweight, or they're too old, or we just think that they are too frail for a transplant. Then we put that in for the sole purpose of getting them to where they need to be. That we're hoping that we can give them some increased survival and hopefully an increased quality of life with the VAD, knowing that over time they're going to eventually die with their VAD, whether it's from heart failure or whether it's from something else. For the bridge to transplant patients, these are patients that they are listed for transplant, that we've decided that your heart's getting too sick, that you meet transplant eligibility, we put you on the transplant list, and then we watch vigilantly because that wait is so long that when we notice that they are starting to decline or their Intermax level is dropping, that they're getting closer and closer and closer to end of life, that we intervene with some sort of mechanical pump to help them survive longer so that they can hopefully get to the transplant. And this is a concept that's really important as you're preparing people, because you know, destination therapy, it's a lot easier to talk to somebody about what it's like to die with a VAD than it is somebody with a bridge to transplant, because it's a very optimistic, hopeful environment of doing this to hopefully get them to a really long-term survival. But at any moment, when you have a complication from, as we start to talk about some of the complications from VADs, a bridge to transplant patient, the second they lose their transplant eligibility, becomes a destination therapy, because we're not going to take this thing out. So preparing them for the fact that we're hoping that you get to a transplant, but that there is some degree of a possibility that you'll have a complication over the coming weeks and months and even years that would leave you not transplant eligible, and now this is the device that's going to give you the longest survival. Okay? So let's talk about a few of the devices. So there are really just three devices out there in the world. So there's a HeartMate 2, there's a HeartWare, and there's a HeartMate 3. Okay? And the reason I mention the devices is that and I mention them by brand name, is that they're the ones that most people are using in the United States, and they're a little bit different in their physiology, and they're a little bit different to shut off. But I think it gives us a concept of how they work. So a HeartMate 2, it has an aortic post, it has a left ventricular post, and this comes down to, this is metal. And it comes down, and you have okay. So they go in surgically, and they implant this into the heart. So they puncture, and they put in this metal post. Inside this, there's a propeller that's powered by an electromagnet. And you basically suck blood out of the left ventricle. You spin it at a really high rate of speed so that it has a high velocity. And you eject it into the aorta. Okay? This augments the way that the heart produces a cardiac output. It does not completely take over the work of the heart. So you still get filling of the native ventricle. It squeezes. Some of the blood is being pulled out, but it still squeezes. Usually, typically, after the transplant, you still have some degree of pulsatility. So What actually makes a pulse? Med students.
Ventricular contraction.
More importantly, what actually makes the thump?
Valves.
Yes, so it's the opening of the aortic valve. And so that creates your systole and the diastole and creates your pressure differential. So basically, if the heart is still beating hard enough and filling full enough that when it squeezes, it pushes blood forward enough that it still opens your aortic valve, then you still have some degree of pulsatility and you still have a systole and a diastole. Eventually, over time, as the heart becomes weaker, more of the blood is going to be filled through this, and you're not going to generate enough pressure with every beat to actually physically open the aortic valve. Does that make sense? So, you know, like let's say your cardiac output is like 1 point, like we'll go really low, but like 1 liter per minute. Okay, when you get the VAD put in. And then this is going to augment and do like 5 liters per minute. So you have 6 liter per minute cardiac output. the hope is like maybe every third beat, you're still going to generate enough pressure as this is filling that you can open the aortic valve and still have a systole and a diastole. But eventually over time, these become non-pulsatile. Okay, so it's a continuous flow pump. At some point, you are no longer going to have a pulse, and you're no longer going to have a traditional blood pressure that is systole and diastole. You're simply going to have a MAP. When you do this, you measure it like you would do any other blood pressure, but you usually do it with a Doppler. So you put the blood pressure cuff on, and you start the Doppler, and you listen for the sound, and when it's there and when it's not, that's your MAP. So you really have to kind of flip your brain around. When somebody still is pulsatile, or they have a more traditional pulse, but eventually over time they're going to be pulseless, you're not going to feel a pulse, they're still going to have a cardiac output, and they have a MAP. Okay? For the heart wear, it is more of kind of a small hockey puck with an aortic, or with a, I keep calling it aortic, with a left ventricular post. And instead of a propeller, this one is a centrifuge. Okay? And then it's the same, it's got an aortic track that comes out here. And so it's still pulling blood in, and it's spinning, and so it's spinning it really fast, and it's ejecting it. Same principle, though. Still pulsatile, eventually more non-pulsatile. And then for the HeartMate 3, it's very similar to the HeartWare in that it's gone from a propeller to a centrifuge. Okay? The other thing that you just have to know. So all of these things are electric. They're powered by electricity. It's an electromagnet. So you have a power cord that comes out of this thing, and it comes out of the body just like a central line would. So it travels from the LVAD. It tracks down. They usually tunnel it for a really long way, so it originates clearly on the left side of the body. It's a left ventricular assist device. So it travels down the left side of the body, and then they track it over, and it usually exits on the right side. You have a really long tunneled catheter, so that if you have to treat this just like a central line, it has to be sterilely dressed and has to be cleaned. So if you get a driveline infection, so this is called the driveline, if you get the driveline infection, then it can usually be debrided, treated with antibiotics, and then they even have the potential to move it to a new location before it tracks all the way up to the VAD. So that's the reason it has such a long cord. You have battery packs, so you have a little vest, you have little batteries that attach to it. They can be charged, plugged into the wall. People plug in to sleep at night. And then you can exchange your batteries, you can charge your batteries. You usually have about 8 hours of batteries with you at any given time.
Does the centrifuge produce less like hemolysis of red blood cells than the propeller? Is that where they're switching? Or?
Not really. Okay. That's the other thing. So the HeartMate 2, it's the oldest technology, and so it's approved for destination therapy. And the others, we have less long-term data, but there's actually a study right now that's head-to-head looking at HeartWare versus HeartMate 2 for like longevity purposes, because the thought is for bridge-to-transplant patients, you're not going to have it in as long, and so we have evidence for that length of time, but we're comparing them head-to-head. We'll talk, if I have time, we'll talk about some of the temporary devices. And those have less dispersing of heat, and that's one of the reasons that they cause so much more hemolysis. So in the HeartMate 2, this one kind of floats, and so it doesn't produce as much heat because the way that the centrifuge floats in there. But when the HeartMate 2, there are ruby bearings that disperse the heat. so that the propeller doesn't produce heat to cause as much hemolysis. So you usually don't have too many problems with hemolysis with these. Any questions so far? Okay. So what are some of the complications that you think could happen from these?
Infections.
Yes, you were listening. Infections. So in the palliative care world, this is a big one. Especially for the bridge transplant patients. You know, this thing gets infected and you hope that you can stop it. But you know, if this tracks all the way up and you have a really infected LVAD or you get a pretty significant infection around the heart, it's really not a good thing to massively immunosuppress somebody and put in a brand new heart. So this becomes challenging, and then based on what kind of the bacteria it is, if they can exchange, sometimes they can exchange out the pump if they think it's just the pump that's infected. We can do a pump switch out, but it's challenging, right? If you're waiting for an organ, that's all the time that you're not on the list. Okay, what else?
Stroke.
So for patients that are on this, you're at a risk for both kinds of strokes, hemorrhagic and occlusive. So clearly when you have this much metal and hardware in somebody, they have to be anticoagulated. So they're on Coumadin and usually aspirins. They're on dual therapy. And so you're anticoagulated the whole time. And these are patients that often have coronary artery disease and have atherosclerotic disease. So a lot of these patients are very predisposed to having plaques in their cerebral flow. And now we're anticoagulating them to the hilt. And so that's something that's a very real possibility of having a hemorrhagic stroke. The other thing is an occlusive stroke, that if this, let's say we form a little clot in one of these, when it throws it right into the aorta, right above the valve, ready to go straight to the head. So it's a really real problem. So it's actually interesting. So when you look at strokes, 30 to 60% of all strokes that are going to occur with a VAD occur in the first 72 hours after surgery. So the perisurgical period is significant. When I first learned about VADs, the thought process was that continuous flow somehow altered cerebral autoregulation, that without systole and diastole, the vessels of the brain couldn't autoregulate. There was actually just a recent study published where they took 10 CABG patients and they took 10 patients that got LVADs. They did transcranial Dopplers and they measured flow in the brain as blood pressure varied. And they didn't see much difference between LVADs and CABG patients. So some of it's probably also due to kind of one of the biggest risks of stroke perioperatively is going on bypass. You have to be really, you have to anticoagulate people significantly. They get a big heparin load. You suddenly change the flow. And so some of it may be related to the VAD itself. Some of it's probably related to the bypass itself. Really unclear. And then the third one is bleeding. So, if you get a VAD, you're going to bleed. It is what it is. Patients that have non-pulsatile blood flow have an increased risk of forming arteriovenous malformations. And so, when you're anticoagulated, they have a significant problem with forming AVMs in the nasal mucosa and also in the GI tract. So, here you have somebody with an IR of 4 walking around and They have an AVM in their nasal mucosa, and they'll get a really significant GI bleed or nosebleed, or they'll get one in their large bowel and they'll have a large GI bleed. So one of our main causes for readmission is GI bleeding. So it's just something you kind of have to prepare somebody for when you're talking to them about a medicalized life. You really have to prepare them for frequent admissions for known complications. That's not when they're going to happen, not if they're going to happen, it's when they're going to happen. but I think when we're talking about turning off LVADs, it's really important to know what people are going to have. And the last and the biggest and the number one reason that people die from VADs is right heart failure. Okay. So, the indications, it's for left ventricle failure. It's for one ventricle problems. So, let's just think through a scenario. These numbers are really low, but if they're dramatic for a reason, okay? So let's imagine that you have a cardiac output of 1 liter per minute on the left. And your right side is good, okay? The whole time that your left side is malfunctioning, you're only going to get 1 liter of blood return on the right. So it only has to keep up with 1 liter a minute. So it's not that much strain on the right side of the heart. And then we take you to the OR and we put in an LVAD and we crank it up to 6 liters per minute. And over a sudden, like a very short period of time, this right heart's going to have to go from keeping up to 1 liter a minute to 6 liters a minute. For no better terms, it's basically like you're giving them a PE, right? You're all of a sudden increasing the flow to the right side of the heart, and it has to be able to generate enough oomph to push that blood out. So typically when people go to the OR to get a VAD, they come out on inotropic support, and it's not for the left side of the heart, it's for the right side of the heart. We have to like really ramp up the support of the right side of the heart so it can deal with that sudden increased flow. And then over a period of days, we wean off those inotropes so that the right heart can pick up and do what it should have been doing the whole time. But, you know, when we think about causes of heart failure, a heart attack, right? You take out your LED. Well, likely if you've taken out your LED and we give you 10 more years, you probably have some disease in your RCA as well. And so if over time you start to develop ischemic changes in the right side of your heart, it's still going to have to pick up the slack for this normal cardiac output on the left. And eventually over time, it probably won't. And so that's one of the ways that you can see that steady decline is actually right heart failure, that we start this whole process again. We give you four or five good years with a VAD, and then the right side starts to peter out, and you start this process again of diuresing and coming in and dealing with the complications of right heart failure. And instead of having large extremity edema, they've got ascites, they've got liver dysfunction, they're short of breath, and we've got to start this process of diuresis. So if you think about other indications, so what are some other causes of cardiomyopathy other than ischemic cardiomyopathy? Just big baskets. Why else would your heart stop working?
Drugs
and alcohol. So it's usually a dilated cardiomyopathy. So in those sorts of cases, it often affects the left side more, but it's still a global dysfunction, right? So we get all these patients where we have severe LV dysfunction and moderate RV dysfunction. So there's a lot of debate when we're going into the surgery, like we hope that the right side's going to be able to do it. You know, we start them on some inotropes before and we see that it's gone from moderate dysfunction to not too dysfunctional with some inotropic support. So that tells us that it still has some oomph, and they kind of put their heads together and think, are they going to have like a right-sided collapse after they put this VAD in? Other causes like amyloidosis, sarcoidosis. So that's a really global dysfunction of the heart. And so you really have to think long and hard when you're going to put these patients on a VAD. And that's in the palliative care world where I know these people are going to, I'm going to see them over time. You know, I'm really putting my feelers out there for right heart failure and talking to them about this decline of right heart failure, because it's not like an ischemic patient where they have a pristine right side of the heart and they've had you can get these patients years and years and years. But if you have somebody that has really bad amyloidosis or really bad sarcoidosis and they have evidence of it in the right side of their heart, we're not going to stop it from happening. They either get a transplant, and we buy them a lot of time, or if we're doing those for a DTVAD patient, that's going to continue to progress, and you don't really know how long you're going to be able to get them support from the right side of their heart. And the other big category out there that we don't ever think about is arrhythmias, right? So people have like this heart failure with recurrent VTs. They are not great VAD candidates, because when you have VT, it doesn't just affect the LV, it affects the RV. And so if these people keep going into recurrent ventricular tachycardia, it's just really going to put a lot of strain on the right side of the heart, and they're not going to be able to do it. Okay?
Mm-hmm. All right, do you ever put in an ICD and an LVAD if you have mm-hmm. that kind of case?
They do. So they often continue their ICD. That's important when we finally get to our actual topic of discontinuing them. But, you know, as we think about preparedness planning in these patients, it's important to, I talk about all this stuff because it's important to understand what the VAD does. It's important to think and look at the patient about what they're going to experience over their life and try to explain to them, you know, we're hoping you get to a transplant or you're not a transplant candidate. And then once they've hit the DT stage, talking to them about what it's like to live with a VAD, that, you know, you're going to have to be in the hospital probably at least a couple times a year for bleeding or some other sort of complication. I'm talking to them about bleeding, infection, and stroke. And, you know, let's say you have a stroke. You have a small disability. What do you want to be able to do mentally? What do you want to be able to do physically? And where do you want to be? Your location of care. We can't do dialysis the same in a VAD patient. There's not a lot of nursing homes, you know. We have a big VAD center here, so we have a lot more connections than we do in other parts of the world. But even in LA, we didn't have a nursing home that would take somebody with a VAD. So what do? When we send you home and you have a small stroke and your family can't care for you anymore, you're going to be in the hospital for the rest of your life. Or an LTAC, if we can find the one in Los Angeles that would even take a patient with an LVAD. So it really just changes, and when we go back and think about that level of what kind of quality of life is acceptable to you, really trying to work with the patient over time so that we know, are you above that line or are you below the line? Because you're going to have complications over time, and as long as we're above the line, then we're doing our job. If we're below the line, then it's not. And that's really how I frame this to patients. The purpose of a VAD is to prolong a good quality of life. And if it's prolonging an adequate quality of life for you, then the VAD's serving its medical purpose. If we get to a point where we're prolonging a poor quality of life, the pump is no longer serving its medical purpose and therefore needs to be shut off. And just saying that to patients, you have to tell patients that this is implanted life support. They often don't think of it like that. We're talking about a pump, and you know, in 1950, these things were massive, and they were controlled by controllers that were half the size of the room. They were like a ventilator. Most of the parts were external. You could see the blood flowing and spinning, and that's what they were. But now we've shrunken them. We can put them internally into the body. Your controller is now the size of an iPhone that you wear around your waist, and you have some batteries and those sorts of things. But, you know, 50 years ago, these things were massive. And so just wrapping their brain around the fact that we are artificially prolonging life with life support, even though it's fully implanted, and that it changes how you live, and it changes how you die. Death no longer becomes a natural process. Death becomes a decision that involves turning off life support. And I think even saying that and letting people sit with it and letting people think about it, having somebody in the family that's willing and able to make that decision. You know, I've had so many patients hear that and change their surrogate decision maker because in no way would they have a family member that was their, like, their spouse. They say, the spouse hears it, they hear it, they're like, I would never be able to make that sort of decision. But maybe their daughter can or their son can. And so they have a family conference, and this is part of the decision process. So I think before we even talk about turning it off, they have to know that you can shut it off. Most people think it's permanent and that it's going to be in there forever and there's no way to shut it off. People have to grasp that they can. And people have to be mentally prepared to do it, because it's sometimes a profound event that people have a sudden death after you shut it off. So just starting that process is really, really critical. And that's most of what we do with preparedness planning. It's just sitting down and really figuring out where that line is. Where is the line of quality of life that's okay for them? Everybody kind of puts a lot of stress in the palliative care world about doing a preparedness plan. In my brain, doing a preparedness plan is no different than any other goals of care conversation in the world. It's different that you have to understand what the device is. You have to understand kind of the concepts of the device and the trends of the device and how people die with a VAD. But our role in palliative medicine, we should be able to sit down with somebody and determine where that line is, whether it's from cancer or whether it's from any sort of chronic illness, COPD. What sorts of things and goals and values are meaningful to you? Okay. All right. Now we're going to talk a little bit about discontinuing. So, just so that everybody doesn't panic about the numbers and the things, if you're in a hospice setting or in a hospital setting, these patients are experts at caring for this device. It's an ambulatory device that they take care of 24/7. All of their family members care for it 24/7. When it bells and it alarms and it freaks out because of all the different things that it bells and alarms for, they know what to do. Their families know what to do. And so especially in a home hospice setting, your goal is to keep them comfortable. If we've transitioned somebody to home hospice with a VAD, their goal is to not go back to the hospital. Their goal is to be focused on being comfortable and stable at home. And so we shouldn't have to worry about all the alarms and bells and whistles, and they're going to know what to do and how to silence them. So it's stressful when they're alarming and they're doing those things, but families know what to do. And you're in every team, there's a VAD coordinator. The VAD coordinator is a nurse that is linked and paired with this patient for the entire life of the VAD and the life of the patient, and they know them. They have called thousands of times in their lifetime to talk them through alarms and whistles, and they're your best friend. Like, don't recreate the wheel. Don't have your staff need to know every detail about every bell and whistle. Use the support that they've had. They've been ambulatory with this thing for often years and not had to have a physician or a nurse in their house helping them through the process, okay? So the things that you're going to see on the VAD pump itself, so you see power and you see flow and you see RPMs. Okay? This is the only thing that's set, and the other two vary. Okay? So you may set it at 9,600 RPMs that will generate 5 liters of flow and require X amount of power to make that happen. Okay? So I just say this for basics so that you understand the pump. So let's imagine that you had somebody that was at 9,600 RPMs and all of a sudden their flow dropped over a day to 3 liters per minute. That meant that the pump is not pumping as much blood, and it took 4 times the power to pump that same amount. Just think, go back to your physics world. That thing is having to crank hard and hard and hard to pump less blood. What do you think could have happened?
Clogging.
it clotted. So, you know, you have a set RPM, you can think through a lot of the alarms, okay? It's cranking, it's taking more and more power to turn this thing 9,600 RPMs and there's no blood coming out of it. So you think clot. Now let's go the opposite. The flow dropped and the power dropped significantly. It's just spinning in there really easily and nothing's flowing through it.
No blood.
So they're really volume down. They're getting septic. The pump's not pumping much. They're, you know, vasodilated. They are bleeding. There's low volume, low pressure. So, and that's the principle of it. Your RPMs are set, your flow and your power vary. And often you can think through what the alarm means. Sometimes this thing sucks to the, if they're really volume down, or sometimes a structural disease, like where it's really not dilated, like those amyloid patients, where the ventricle's really tiny, where you have a really big hypertroph, like hypertrophic cardiomyopathy. Their ventricle size isn't very big, so this thing's sucking, and it's just like a vacuum, right? And it sucks to the side of the ventricle, and all of a sudden you get low-flow alarms, and they feel woozy, and then eventually, like, there's no blood flowing anymore, and so it unsucks again, and they perk up, and the flow peaks, and things like that. And so these intermittent suction alarms, you get low-flow, they feel awful. So those are some things you could give some patients, some fluid, and those sorts of things. But that's a prime example. If you've got a VAD coordinator that knows them really well, and if they've been having suction alarms for years and years and years and years and years, and you go and see your patient and they're like, they're getting dizzy and passing out, and you know, they keep having these like low flow alarms, the VAD coordinator will probably say, oh, they probably have a suction event, they're really volume down, maybe you can give them a liter of fluid and they'll feel great. And that's something that the prime example of, use your resources. The patient will probably know what that alarm means and be able to work you through it. Okay, so the 10 minutes of exactly what you do when you shut off a VAD is that it's no different than any other end-of-life situation. Some things I look for. So you try to predict how fast a patient's going to die with the VAD, which is extremely unpredictable. But this is where I go back to, it's an assist device, right? If the heart is still doing a ton of work, and you shut off the VAD, they're probably not going to feel that much, and they're probably going to live for a prolonged period of time. And it's really no different than shutting off an inotrope. If they're still pulsatile, so discontinuation. Pulse. If that thing's generating a pulse with every beat, it's still doing some work. And so if you shut off the VAD, it's going to feel even more and still generate a pulse. And so you probably have a more significant period of time to be able to turn off the VAD and let their heart do its native function and let it gradually decline over time. In that sort of situation, I think of it just like turning off an inotrope, that you think to yourself that you don't really know how much their heart's doing, and it may be a really sudden, rapid decline, and you need to prepare for things like flash pulmonary edema and those sorts of things, but that it may be a gradual decline over days to weeks. So in all these situations, I give them a little bit of opioid beforehand and think through, what am I going to do if this changes rapidly, right? Old school patients. So things have changed a lot over how we put these VADs in over time. And people that just got their VAD put in yesterday, it's probably going to be in their chest a little bit different. So I like to know what their echo looks like. And So I want to know what their echo looks like, because if you've had this VAD for a long period of time, back when they first started doing HeartMate 2s, they thought that they were worried about the aortic root. Okay? When you have increased flow that's kind of going above the aortic valve, you often get a dilated aortic root over time, and you get really significant aortic insufficiency. So that aortic root dilates and you get really bad AI. And that's just something you have to be aware of. If somebody has some degree of pulsatility, but they have a wide open aortic valve, they're probably going to have a fairly sudden decline, and they're probably going to have pretty significant symptoms right after you shut this thing off. Because right now they're completely supported by the VAD, and their heart is beating and it's all flowing right back in. And so they're probably going to have a really significant sudden change in symptoms afterwards. The other thing is that when they first started doing this, they were so worried about the aortic insufficiency that they oversewed the aorta. So they have no cardiac output. Okay? And so that's just something to be very, very aware, that if your patient has an oversewn aorta, we haven't done it here in several years, but I know some other institutions that did it as long as a couple of years ago. And so if they have an oversewn aorta, it's going to be a very sudden end of life after you've discontinued the VAD. And in those patients, we don't know what they experience. So I tend to be much more liberal with my sedation medications, sedating them to, you know, so that they're mostly sedated, but they're still breathing and they still respond to deep stimulus, but that they are mostly asleep, and turn it off, and have opioid medications ready in case they have a sudden symptoms. Now that's challenging because, so just remember, so you don't know how strong that aorta is. It's been oversewn for a while. It's a very dilated root. You sometimes have some leak, and so it's not always a sudden death, but it's likely going to be a sudden death. And if it is oversewn, you will not get another chance to give them medicines after it's shut off because you will have no circulation. So all you've got is what you've got before you turn this off. And that's a very common thing with VADs, right? You're turning off their assist device. You don't quite know how much the heart's going to do. And if it's not going to do much, it's not going to circulate meds, and you're not going to get them into the system. So with all of these, it's very important to know the physiology of the heart, of what you're shutting off, be able to just think it through a little bit, and then be able to predict what you're going to give. And you need to be generous with your medicines because you're not going to get in most of these cases, you're not going to get a second chance because the blood just simply isn't going to be flowing. Okay? Other scenarios of things that... Does anybody... I'll pause there for a second. Does anybody have any questions? So it's not hard. Like, you... This can be done anywhere. I think people often worry it has to be done in a hospital setting, it has to be done in an inpatient. It doesn't. If you have Dilaudid or morphine and Versed, you give them an opioid, you give them a benzo, you sedate them so that they're minimally conscious and well sedated, and the VAD, you talk to your VAD coordinator about how to shut off that specific model. You shut it off, you make sure that you take it out of the room so that they don't hear the alarms, and that's it. And then you treat it just like somebody that you've discontinued an inotrope or you've extubated, right? It's the same. You often think about how you think about your extubation patients, right? If they have IPF and their lungs are concrete, it's a very different mental mindset going in to take this tube out than somebody that has been chronically on a trach for 15 years and is still breathing underneath of it, and they've decided that they're going to extubate. It's probably going to be a much longer end-of-life process, and you're just kind of mentally prepared in a different way how you're going into the room. But it's based on the physiology of the lungs. It's the same with the heart. You just have to know the physiology of your heart. The other thing that I just want to mention that is becoming more and more and more common in the world. Have you guys heard of an Impella? Does anybody? So we just have one? Okay. So this is a temporary ventricular assist device that you may run across in all sorts of scenarios in the hospital because they're becoming more and more and more common. Okay? So this is, it's an assist device that's inserted temporarily through the groin and is FDA approved for about 5 days of use. They sometimes use it longer or shorter, depending on how long it's supporting the patient, how long they're tolerating it. So they go through the groin and it's inserted through a catheter and it comes up and goes in. Okay? So it's just like they're going to do a cardiac cath. So they often use these for, if you ever hear that it is a high-risk PCI, that typically means that it's being supported by an Impella. So if you're going to go in and muck around with three vessels, you're going to have the balloon time open for a long period of time, and then you worry they're going to have some cardiac stunning, they often will put in an Impella to support the heart while they're doing all the other things. So one will go in through the groin, and the other one will go in through the other groin, and they'll be opening up the vessels while this is, it's basically a mini LVAD, for no better terms. So what this does is it has a little propeller here at the end that is spinning, same, spinning at like 9,600 RPMs, whatever it is, and sucking blood in, and then there's an opening on this end of the, so it's basically like this, it goes through the valves, and it sits here and sucks blood here and spits it out there. But depending on the girth of the cannula, you can get bigger or lower flow. So you're seeing a lot more of these, like somebody has an acute MI and they have an acutely reduced rejection fraction, they'll put them on an Impella for a few days to help augment the blood flow while the heart is hopefully recovering. You often see this after PCI, they'll come out for a period of time. There's more and more patients on the floor with these things and just knowing that, like, what it is, that in some ways it's a ventricular assist device. It's sucking blood from the left side of the heart. The heart's still beating, doing its thing. They're anticoagulated, but it's just very temporary.
This is what's taking the place of the aortic balloon pumps in a lot of centers.
So the question was, is this what's taking the place of the aortic balloon pumps? So, yes. So the last hospital I was at, I didn't see a balloon pump the entire time I was there. Some institutions are still using balloon pumps. But yes, so they're using this to kind of augment flow during the procedure or after the procedure. But it's just important to know what it is when you're going into a critical care setting and thinking about discontinuing technology. It's just important to know what it is and that it kind of is in that ventricular assist device world. Anybody have any questions? Okay. All right. Thank you, everyone.
Thanks again for tuning in. I hope you'll rate and review this podcast and share it with your colleagues and your friends so you don't miss any of our new content. Make sure you are subscribing to PCIC podcasts. PCIC is sponsored by PalMed, where our aim is to advance palliative care globally and ensure all clinicians have the latest knowledge and skill. To access more PCIC content, please visit palmed.us to review our extensive open access PCIC curriculum.